These are women, but also over 60% of the caregivers are women. So when we look at these numbers, when we look at the numbers that say that, you know, right now, if we just look at the state of Florida, there's 500,000 people in the state of Florida over 65 years old that have Alzheimer's disease. 500,000. So we have 10% of all the people in America. There's over 5 million, 5.2 on one study, 5.5 on another study. But what they're talking about is that number tripling over the next 35 years. So, you know, if you're somebody listening to the show and you're 35 years old, 35 years from now, we've got 16 million people in the country with Alzheimer's disease. The cost for caring those, for those individuals, not just with Alzheimer's, but with the other dementias, are estimated in the, I'm sorry to say it out loud, trillion plus dollars. And that's based on today's dollars. Nearly one in three seniors who dies each year has Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. It doesn't get talked about enough. It doesn't get talked about enough because there isn't any cure. I mean, there's 85 drugs that are out there. Seriously, there are 85 drugs that are out there. None of them work. You know, this is the only one of the major killers that we do not have treatment for. We do not have, certainly don't have a cure for, but we don't even have treatment for. So when we look that one out of two people have Alzheimer's disease by age 85, one out of two, it's astounding. 21% of all seniors are living with some kind of dementia. And so it's, well, it's just flat out scary because a whole lot of people do expect as they age that something's going to break, something's going to wear out, something's not going to work as well. You know, a lot of people accept a certain amount of disability as they get older, which is really kind of silly. Because you can do what my grandmother endorsed, and that's live, 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 croak. But everybody that comes into my practice says when they forget something, I just want to make sure my brain is okay. Well, knowing you don't know is different than not knowing you don't know. I'm going to say that again. If you know you don't know, that's a good thing. When my husband turns to me and says, what's the name of that band that's playing on the TV now? And I go, I don't know. And he'll say, well, you know, 600 plants in 5 languages. I go, yeah, because I'm interested in that. And it's working knowledge. It's stuff that I use every day. I'm not particularly interested in the name of that band. But remember, everybody forgets stuff. You remember that movie title that was on the tip of your tongue? The name of that guy who used to live next door? The appointment you forget. I forgot one. What the heck did you just come in the room for? So slowed recall of information from time to time is really normal. That's a naturally aging brain. That's other lifestyle factors like trying to cram too many tasks into one day. What's not normal is when memory impairment interferes with your ability to get through the day. So it's a reassuring sign that you can still work, prepare meals, dress yourself, manage your checkbook, pursue your hobby, read a novel, without needing help. So start right there. If you forget what happens when you go into the room and you go, what did I come in here for? That's part of the normal aging brain. If you improve after brain training, you know, there's these various web courses you can buy and there are puzzles that show up in the mail. I subscribe to one of the updates on drugs, and they send brain games every time they send an issue. And those brain games improve the way that you have recall. If you do any of that kind of brain training or brain fitness that strengthens our synapses and buffers our brain power, you know, there's no evidence that it can reverse the memory loss associated with Alzheimer's related decline, but has a naturally protective value. And there are all kinds of mental exercises we're going to talk about that can protect the brain. If you just went on a new medication, Doesn't matter what the medication is for. Drug side effects, they call them side effects. They really aren't side effects. They're mechanisms of action. But they're one of the more common unexpected causes of memory problems. In fact, adults who take multiple prescriptions have an increased risk of dangerous interactions. The problem is so common that geriatricians believe new symptoms should be considered a medication side effect until proven otherwise. Now, there are medications that are known to cause short-term memory loss. The anti-anxiety drugs and the sedatives like Xanax and Valium and Ambien, the heartburn drugs like Tagamet and Pepcid, the incontinence drugs like Ditropan and Detrol, all the statin drugs, you know, Lipitor and the whole rest of the list, antidepressants, all of these things are known to create short-term memory loss. So if you've just started a new drug, before you think that you've fallen off the pier, make sure you report it to your clinician that you've had a difference in your memory since you were put on the drug. And remember, it's not serious if you're the only one that's worried. If nobody else notices anything amiss, I remember my great and good friend and client, Betty, when it was clear that Betty had deterioration going on in terms of her memory. It wasn't just the occasional lapse. And I went to her house, and she had her bra on outside of her dress. Yeah. Then you know something's amiss. You might think you're sleeping. Your brain is sleepy and slipping. And you say something goofy, and somebody around you doesn't say anything to protect your feelings. But what's really true is that when you start forgetting appointments and messages and, you know, losing stuff and the rest of your family and your friends start to notice, then we have a different kind of problem. Unfortunately, relatives often make up a dementia diagnosis earlier than medical people do. So if you're just joking over the occasional tiffs, you know, Nora Ephron titled her new book, I Remember Nothing, odds are nobody else is alarmed. And also, if you're really stressed, if you're sleep deprived, if you're multitasking, before you think about the work or think about the workload, a stressed brain is not the same as a demented one. When you try to do two or more things, I mean, I've had clients and they're, you know, remodeling their house and their brain turns to soup. I got one that's planning a wedding right now and it's big and people are coming in from out of the country and in the country and, you know, there's the coordination of all of the caterers and the hotel and the pastor and the, all of that stuff. And so you're switching attention from one thing to another. You're attending to one thing, you're not really attending to the other. You know, multitasking is an illusion. But what's true is if you're trying to talk on the phone and type at the same time, something's got to give. So it's probably not serious if you're stressed. People with early dementia, on the other hand, tend to forget regardless of whether they're sleeping well or busy or slow or stressed or unstressed. They still forget. So when we begin to look at what's not a worry, remember, when you're 60 years old, you've got twice as many post-it notes in your brain as you did when you were 30 years old. You've met twice as many people. You've had twice as many phone numbers. You've had twice as many vacations that you've gone on, hopefully. So if you're on a new med or you're the only one that's worried or you're really stressed or underslept, if it doesn't really interfere with your daily life, then it's probably not serious. But when memory loss disrupts daily life, especially in the early stages, we forget recently learned information. New stuff. You and I make plans to go to dinner on Tuesday night and I don't show up. We forget important dates and events. We ask for the same information over and over. We rely on all kinds of memory aids, whether it's electronic devices or those reminder notes. We ask for help for things we used to handle by ourselves. What's normal? We forget names, we forget appointments, but we remember them later. I mean, how many of us have been in the middle of a conversation and we couldn't remember somebody's name, and 20 minutes later, we're doing something completely different? We go, oh yeah, I remember. Everybody has a perfect memory, we just don't have perfect recall. But when you see people, they're challenged in planning, challenged in problem solving. They can't work with numbers anymore. They can't develop and follow a plan. They have trouble following a familiar recipe or keeping track of monthly bills. They have difficulty concentration. The difficulty with concentration enables them to not do things that they used to do before. That's different from making an error when you balance a checkbook. You didn't go south just because you made an error when you were doing that. It's when the challenges in planning or solving problems start to become much more familiar, much more frequent. I remember the tragic story of the client who is suspicious about her husband's well-being, and I had told her about what the warning signs are. I told her about what the normal stuff was, and she came out in the kitchen one morning and he was standing in front of the coffee maker and he didn't remember how to make a pot of coffee. Now, you don't really think about all the steps it takes to make a pot of coffee, but you know, you have to pull out the filter tray and you have to put a filter in it, and then you have to put the coffee in the filter and you have to put the filter tray back, and then you have to take out the pot and you fill it up with water and you pour the water in a certain place, and then you put the pot back under there and then you push the button and then the whole thing happens. Well, I went through that in less time than you could do that, but he couldn't remember the order, and that was the sign that we knew that early detection had taken place. When somebody has difficulty completing familiar tasks, that's really what it is, making the pot of coffee. They can't make that complete task. They don't remember the rules of the card game. They can't remember exactly where that store is when they're driving. They need help using the settings on all of their equipment. Now, for somebody who's electronically challenged like I am, you know, I always joke and say, well, it's just because I'm blonde. But, you know, ask me to record a favorite television show? Yikes. I'm not sure about doing that. You know, occasionally I do need help with the settings on the computer, like virtually every day. Why? Because it doesn't happen to be an area that I'm particularly interested in. And so you have to understand that our attention follows our interest. If we have confusion with time and place, we're not only losing track of dates and seasons and the passage of time, but we might forget where we are or how we got there. You know, getting confused about the day of the week, I'm here to tell you. That's pretty common. What is it, Monday? Is it Tuesday? Yeah, that can happen, especially if you've had a few days off or you've been on vacation. Vision problems is a sign of Alzheimer's. We have difficulty reading or judging distance or determining color or contrast. Somebody passes a mirror and thinks someone else is in the room. They don't even recognize their own reflection. That's different from vision changes that are related to cataracts. You know, one of the reasons that I ask all of you to eat all those high antioxidant foods and take supplements like S-acetylglutathione and N-acetylcysteine and all of these things that build these antioxidants in the body is because it inhibits the development of cataracts. So we're not talking about not having good vision in relation to cataracts. What we're talking about is the judgment that comes from vision. New problems with words, whether it's speaking or writing. You know, sometimes people have trouble joining a conversation. They stop in the middle of a conversation. They have no idea how to continue. Now, once again, sometimes all of us have trouble finding the right word. Some of us, you know, we go to sit down and we go, what was I talking about? Again, we aren't very focused. If we misplace things and lose the ability to retrace the steps, We can't go back over the steps and figure out that we put something where it didn't belong. I tell a story on myself years ago. I came home one night. I was bone tired, and I walked in the door and put all my stuff away. You know, you put down your keys, you put down your purse. And the next morning I got up and I couldn't find my purse. And I'd sworn somebody had broken into the house and stolen it. I mean, a clear sign when you accuse somebody else of stealing. I couldn't understand. I walked, went out to my car. My purse wasn't in my car. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what have I done with my purse? And I went to make a cup of tea, and I opened the refrigerator to get the milk out for the tea, and there was my purse on the shelf of the refrigerator. I had realized that when I had come home late, I had gone into the fridge to get something cold, a little cup of yogurt to have for dessert. And I had put the purse on the shelf. That's a dingbat thing to admit. But if you misplace your glasses or the remote control, I'm not worried about it. But you need to be able to go back over your steps. You know, when we have poor judgment, dealing with money, you know, giving money to telemarketers, buying that crap that they're trying to sell you on television, if we suddenly don't pay attention to grooming, if we don't keep ourselves clean anymore, you know, I'd love to say none of us make a bad decision once in a while, but what's true is all of us make a bad decision once in a while. But this poor judgment starts showing up more and more. And if something's going on with the memory, we withdraw. We withdraw from work. We withdraw from social activities. We can't keep up with our favorite sports teams. We don't remember how to complete that hobby action that we're doing. They avoid being social. Now, there's some days where I have one brain cell left at the end of a busy practice day, and I don't really want to talk to anybody, and I don't really want to go anywhere, and I'm not very conversational. That's just a feeling of weariness. That's not removing myself from social activities or work projects. But those changes in moods and personality, the confusion, the suspicion, the depression, the fearful, the anxious, easily upset, if they're out of their comfort zone. Now, all of us can become irritable. There's no doubt in my mind about that. But do you see that there's a frequency thing that's going on here that really has to do with knocking on the door of dementia? You know, when the Obama administration started the project to map the human brain back 2 years ago, after the incredible success of the Human Genome Project, President Obama really put forward the funding. It came out in the original State of the Union address 2 years ago, but talk about the government investing in the best ideas. You know, every dollar that we invested in the Human Genome Project returned $140 to our economy. In other words, we made $139 on every dollar the government spent when they investigated the human genome. And that's just so far. Well, we started mapping the human brain to unlock the answers to not only Alzheimer's, but other brain issues. And so when people poo-pooed the Human Genome Project, which ended up costing almost $4 billion, but it returned $800 billion to the federal government already. So this kind of primary research really can only be funded by the government. There's no private universities or organizations that are really funding large amounts of dollars to advance the knowledge of the brain's billions of neurons and gain greater insights into its actions and, you know, ultimately into our consciousness. It's from that kind of research that perhaps new drugs can be developed, drugs that actually have an effect, but as of right now, we don't have a drug that works. You know, if you've got grandma on an Alzheimer's drug, I'm here to tell you, you're just setting fire to your money, or you're setting fire to my money in Medicare dollars, because there isn't any of them that work. There isn't enough understanding of this targeted disease. You know, drug hunting is a vital activity. But when the government finishes working on this brain activity mapping project, then we're going to be in a very much better situation in terms of understanding what's going on in the brain. But let's tell you what we understand right now. What we understand right now is there are very real relationships between diet and the health of your brain, and they have a great deal to do with omega-3 fatty acids. Remember, two-thirds of your brain is fat. You're a fathead, I'm a fathead, we're all a fathead. But what fats are they? If you eat lousy fats, if you eat hydrogenated and partially hydrogenated oils, which mostly come from fast foods, deep fat fried things, and baked goods, more than anything else. You look on the label and it says hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated. Run! Because your brain is two-thirds fat. If you go on a low-fat diet, if you use a statin drug to try to lower cholesterol, which also doesn't work, we've done plenty of shows on the absolute myth of cholesterol control. There is so much evidence that shows now that if your cholesterol is between 200 and 240, you have better memory and better cognitive performance than people who've driven their cholesterol down into the basement. You know, these kinds of reports are not coming from the National Enquirer and from Sports Illustrated. You know, this is coming out of Boston University. You know, looking at individuals that were free of dementia and stroke at the beginning of the study and following them for 18 years, doing cognitive tests on them regularly, there is a significant, I'm quoting now, there is a significant positive linear association between total cholesterol and measures of verbal fluency, attention, concentration, abstract reasoning, and a composite score measuring multiple cognitive domains. Participants with desirable total cholesterol, meaning less than 200, performed less well than participants with borderline high cholesterol levels, 200 to 239, and participants with total high cholesterol, greater than 240. The study concluded that lower naturally occurring total cholesterol levels are associated with poor performance on cognitive measures, which placed high demand on word fluency and executive function and attention and concentration. In other words, people who had the highest cholesterol levels scored higher on cognitive tests than those with lower levels. There is a protective factor when it comes to cholesterol in the brain. That's one of the reasons that you have to start eating eggs on a regular basis. We need the cholesterol and we need the phosphatidylcholine, that fat that I said is in eggs that we don't really get much of in the American diet because we don't eat kidneys and hearts and thymuses and brains like they do in other parts of the world. So those omega-3s that come to us from the fatty fish, that come to us in small amounts from things like walnuts and things like flax. I do not recommend in any way, shape, or form the use of flax oil. I do recommend the use of flax seed, freshly ground, added to things. But, you know, anybody who believes that you can substitute flax for fish is just doesn't understand the science. Those omega-3 fatty acids. And if you don't eat fishes, then consider taking fish oil. And if you're a vegetarian, consider taking DHA from algae. That is one of the two major fats that are in fish oil. And you can get it from algae the same as fish get it from algae. That protects the brain. Sleep protects the brain. Over and over, I hear individuals that go, oh, the older I get, the less sleep I need. I only need 5.5 hours. You're just freaking kidding yourself. There's less than 2% of the population that needs less than 50 hours of sleep a week. And really golly sleep, not just interrupted sleep. And I have to tell you that one drink of alcohol, and one drink is a 12-ounce can of beer or a 5-ounce glass of wine or 1.5 ounces of liquor, that has all about the same amount of alcohol as beneficial to the brain. You know, I can't endorse alcohol because of the amount of pain that it's caused our country and families. But at the same time, I have to acknowledge the research that people who have a little bit, and that isn't saving up and having 3 on Friday and 4 on Saturday. That's 1 a day. But, you know, there's nothing more protective. There's nothing more protective for the brain, for the reduced risk of cardiovascular disease, the reduced risk of cancers, than exercise. Move it or lose it. We're designed to be physically active. And as people become more and more sedentary, they have less and less blood flow, especially to those little teeny tiny blood vessels. I don't know what else to say. You got to move. You got to find something you like to do. Is it taking a walk? Is it going to the gym? Is it working in the yard? Is it riding your bike? But you need to do it on a regular basis. And just like we need physical exercise, we need mental exercise. The things that we found that youth the brain instead of aging the brain are learning to play a musical instrument. When I had my shoulder surgery way back when, I had to learn how to brush my teeth with my left hand. I couldn't touch my face for 7 weeks. So I had to paint my face. I had to, you know, try to dry my hair. Thank you, husband. He blew dry my hair for a long time. But just learning to brush my teeth with my left hand, I thought I was going to put the damn toothbrush through my cheek. But when you use your non-dominant hand to do things, you actually exercise the brain. When you learn how to use a new software, if you start a new hobby, when you travel and explore new places and see new things, all of these things are mental exercises. They set up new neuronal connections. Language. It doesn't appear that there are very many things that make a bigger difference than learning a new language. You can actually measure the growth in the hippocampus volume, the place where memory is initiated in the brain. The gyruses, there's a bunch of different gyruses in the brain, and they actually get thicker as a result of learning a new language. So no, you're not necessarily going to learn to speak fluent Italian, but going and repeating those things and learning those relationships and learning those new sounds, all of that mental exercise is beneficial for the brain. It happens even when you try a new recipe. When you stay socially informed, when you read the paper, when you watch the news, as pappy as it is, when you do something to grow spiritually, whatever is the insight that is meaningful to you, whatever is your personal path, that you pursue that. You know, social interactions, we don't know exactly why social interactions make a difference in terms of longevity and brain function, but they do. And part of that is active listening. You know, active listening is when you're really paying attention. You're not just waiting for your turn to speak. And so when we combine the mental exercise together with the social interactions, you know, we're in a group that's all learning how to speak Italian. You know, we're in a group that's all learning to play the piano. We're in a group that's all learning how to do needlepoint. Any of those kinds of things are beneficial. And if we put mental exercise together with physical exercise, things like yoga and Tai Chi have a big payoff, because Tai Chi improves your balance. And a brand new study, really showed us that balance makes a huge, big difference. You know, when the journal Stroke came out in December of last year, and they took 1,400 people, average age was 67, and they asked them to balance on one foot for 1 minute. If they couldn't balance longer than 20 seconds, when they did the MRIs of their brain, they found out they had more signs in their brain of microbleeds, little teeny tiny strokes that lowered their ability to have an active working memory and lowered their ability to think through things clearly. So just having somebody balance on each foot for 1 minute, this is a 2-minute test, can be a predictor of stroke, can be a predictor of dementia. You know, even the habit of negative thinking. And you know those high cynicism people. The Journal of Neurology published last year that people that are highly cynical are 3 times more likely to end up with some kind of a dementia. The people that have a habit of negative thinking end up with more dementia. The people that are neurotic are 3 times more likely. The people that are easily distressed, they're moody, they're anxious, they're fearful. They have envy, they have jealousy. And it took me a long time to understand the difference between envy and jealousy. Envy says, I want what you have. Jealousy says, I don't want you to have what you have. But those kinds of neurotic behaviors, where people are very easily distressed, you know, the pee under the mattress of the princess, they're the individuals that have much higher risks. We know that there are risks from traumatic brain injuries. You know, Haley House over in Tampa, the hospital facility that treats our veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars who've had TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, when explosive devices have gone off near them, they may not have a wound that shows, but they have a wound between their ears. You know, that brain is about the consistency of custard, and you bang it around inside that hard shell of our skull, and we end up with a TBI, a traumatic brain injury. By the way, nothing reduces that traumatic brain injury faster than a whole lot of omega-3 fatty acids right after it happens. But sports concussions. I had a client who had had concussion after concussion from riding motorcycles and jet skis and even water skiing. Banging that head around inside that hard shell, not a good thing. Exposure to lead and exposure to mercury. You know, those are two of the heavy metals that I test in my practice because I found the relationship of lead and osteoporosis. I found the relationship of lead and hypertension. And I'm even suspicious of the relationship of lead with a diagnosis called gastroparesis, where people's digestive system doesn't work right, but also mercury exposure. You know, mercury exposure most often comes from having mercury fillings. You know, you take a filling out of your mouth, there's only two places you can put it. You can put it in your mouth, or you can put it in a toxic waste dump. But that's it. One single filling could contaminate a 40-acre lake for years. So that exposure to mercury, you know, for those of us that are eating a lot of fish, we need to monitor that. Even if we're not eating fish high in the food chain. You know, I never recommend the use of blue and yellow tuna. I don't care how much you like tuna sushi. I never recommend the use of shark or swordfish, king mackerel, or tilefish. Those are the five fishes the World Health Organization says are toxic at a single dose. So exposure to lead and mercury, you need to monitor it, and you need to treat it. Exposure to pesticides. We know absolutely positively that landscapers, people that work in lawn care, and farmers have higher rates of Parkinson's disease. Not just dementias, but Parkinsonianism as well from exposure to pesticides. We know that there's risks to normal aging. The older we are, the more likely these kinds of things are going to happen. But you can stack the deck. You can stack the deck with your diet and your exercise and your mental exercise and with your sociability and your avoidance of these things and your treatment of these things. You know, we even have to look at the cell phone use. You know, we haven't done very much research about how cell phones have affected brains in the United States because the entire industry of telecommunications is such a big dollar industry in this country. We have to look to places like Sweden and Israel and other countries that are doing more cutting-edge research on what's happening. And in the journal Pathophysiology, they released a very major study on gliomas. Gliomas are a category of tumors, and they often show up in fairly young people, people that are, you know, well, listen to my relativity here, fairly young. They're around 50 years old. But it turns out that gliomas start to increase after 1 year of cell phone use, and they rise with increasing exposure by the hour. In other words, the longer somebody's used a cell phone and the more hours they use it for the day, the higher the glioma risk is. And it's especially true if people started using their cell phones before the age of 20, and that's certainly what's going on now. So we can measure some of these things. Sarasota Memorial Hospital has a memory facility where we can do things like the mini mental state exam. And the Montreal Cognitive Assessment is really a better way to evaluate the brain. It has 11 sections in it that get tested. And what's true is that each of these various sections where we try to evaluate how your brain is working can be done in about a minute. And so the Montreal Cognitive Assessment that's known as MoCA, M lowercase O, uppercase CA, MoCA, Montreal Cognitive Assessment can be done in 10 or 12 minutes. And it enables us to really look at what is going on in terms of somebody's memory function. And so the MoCA study has a total ability to score 30 points. And we're looking for 25 and higher to be normal. And so there will be verbal fluency and delayed recall and abstraction and naming and a whole set of skills, you know, taking a pencil and joining the dots on a particular order. All of those things can be measured so that we can see what the risks are. So if you have a family member and you're starting to see that they're on the slippery slope, then doing a MoCA test may be an appropriate thing. And by the way, it's free. But don't forget that drugs raise risk. You know, a long-term high use of anticholinergic drugs. Remember we talk about phosphatidylcholine? Anticholinergic drugs, in other words, things that suppress that pathway. There was a study that came out just a couple of weeks ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine Journal, that tracked about 3,500 adults that were 65 and older and didn't have any signs of dementia. They did a seven-year follow-up, and in 7 years, 800 of those 3,500 people developed some kind of a dementia. But the ones that took tricyclic antidepressants like Sinequan, that took antihistamines like Benadryl, or took anticholinergic drugs like Ditropan, these are things used for overactive bladder or allergies or sleep problems, they had a much greater risk of dementia. These are over-the-counter drugs, as well as prescription drugs. And they're used to treat a wide variety of conditions, but the thing is, they increase your risk. Just like a study that I released a couple of weeks ago on No Nonsense Nutrition that shows that benzodiazepines that are used as anti-anxiety drugs increase risk. Why in heaven's name would we want to use a drug on a regular basis that increases risk? Now, you get bit by a bee and you take a Benadryl, I'm not going to lose any sleep over that. But if you're taking something with PM in the name, remember PM means there's diphenhydramine in that compound. So it doesn't matter whether it's Excedrin PM or Aleve PM or whatever PM. If there's diphenhydramine in it, like there is in Benadryl and a whole bunch of other antihistamines, then anything other than occasional use becomes dangerous to the brain. Drugs raise the risk. I've talked many times on No Nonsense Nutrition about Dwayne Graveline's work. Dr. Graveline was the astronaut who was given Lipitor as a drug to reduce his cholesterol and developed TGA, transient global amnesia. He forgot that he was a surgeon. He forgot that he had been married for 38 years. He forgot that he was an astronaut. How do you forget that you're an astronaut? And as soon as the cholesterol-lowering drug was removed, his memory came back. And a year later, he went back on the drug at half dose, and exactly the same thing happened all over again. He developed transient global amnesia. Only the second time he retrograded back to high school, he didn't even remember graduating high school. So before we blame the general demise of the brain, let's look and see if there's been an insult to the brain. You know, David Perlmutter, Dr. Perlmutter, has been on PBS, and his books, Grain Brain, and the new one that's coming out, Brain Maker, are really an expose on the relationship between high carbohydrates in the diet and the demise of the brain. So it isn't just too much sugar and too much alcohol. It's just too much grain, and especially Dr. Perlmutter is anti-gluten. And he's anti-gluten for a couple of reasons. First off, the evidence that's already there, and the fact that this this arena of grains is pretty new to the diet, to the evolutionary diet. We only started eating grains about 10,000 years ago, and that seems like a really long time, but from an evolutionary standpoint, it isn't. And so in the book Grain Brain, Dr. clearly shows that the elimination of gluten is just one piece of the puzzle. The insistence on getting cholesterol in the diet, you know, these things run so contrary to what we've been taught to believe. But when we look at long-term studies, you know, the Framingham Heart Study was started in 1948. And it recruited a little over 5,000 men and women from Framingham, Massachusetts, none of whom had had a heart attack or a stroke or had developed any symptoms of cardiovascular disease. Now, over this period of these last 67 years that this study has gone on, generations of individuals stemming from that original group of 5,000 men and women have been used. And the Boston study that I cited for you about the relationship between cholesterol and memory came out of that Framingham collection of information. And so when we look at brain shrinkage, now remember, brain and atrophy are not two words that you want to have in the same sentence. So when we had brain atrophy, what we found out, and this came from an Australian study, was that even people who had blood sugar in a normal range, but they were in the high end of the normal range, were more likely to show a loss of brain volume. This is not a good thing. So the blood sugar and insulin imbalances are epidemic. It's not all about obesity. It's not all about diabetes. It's also about inflammation and how inflammation gets cerebral. Remember, any inflammation that happens in your body happens to your whole body. You get a splinter in the end of your finger, that inflammation goes to your heart, it goes to your brain, it goes everywhere. So when we have this term inflammation, we've got this general sense that something got red and got tender and, you know, swole up and it hurt. There's some kind of a stress in our body, and the body's natural response is to create swelling and pain. These are hallmarks of the inflammatory process. But inflammation isn't always a negative reaction. It's one of the ways that the body goes after those bad bugs and toxins and such that we're exposed to. It's just not supposed to be turned on for prolonged periods of time. But if the body is under constant assault by eating foods that are irritants, if the body's under constant assault because you're exposing yourself to pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, fragrances, the inflammation can go awry. And a series of chemicals can be produced that are directly toxic to our cells. And first we have a reduction in cellular function, and then we have cellular destruction. And so when we look at inflammation, just absolutely rampant in our culture, and yet it is a fundamental cause of mortality, whether it's connected with coronary artery disease or cancer or diabetes or Alzheimer's or any other chronic disease you can imagine. It's not much of a stretch to figure out that inflammation underlies problems like arthritis. After all, the common drugs to treat that condition, you know, like ibuprofen and aspirin, are marked as anti-inflammatories. You know, with asthma, antihistamines are used to combat the inflammatory reaction that occurs when someone's exposed to some sort of irritant. Maybe they're reactive to the cat or the oak pollen. But more and more people are beginning to understand that inflammation is the foundation of coronary disease. It's not the cholesterol. That inflammation is related to brain disease. It's not just bad genes. People have trouble envisioning brain inflammation because it doesn't turn red and hot and swell up and cause pain. We don't feel it like we feel it in the rest of the body. But focusing on reducing inflammation is a big part of enhancing brain health and function, enhancing body health and function. So it doesn't matter whether it's arthritis or asthma. When we reduce the inflammation that's going on chronically in your body, we protect your brain against rapid aging. We protect your brain against Parkinson's. We protect your brain against Alzheimer's and other dementias. But when these cytokines, these inflammatory molecules, these cellular mediators of inflammation start to spike because we're eating a bunch of lousy food, you're out there having St. Patrick's Day celebration and toasting your brain, then you're not doing good things for yourself. You know, I don't want to see the healthcare system bankrupt by Alzheimer's disease. You know, if only one person that's listening to this show makes a change in their choices and as a result of that keeps from having a dementia, then talking about these things that are really hard is worth it. Because when we look at increasing the number of people with Alzheimer's just in the state of Florida, 100,000 more in the next 5 years, the weight of that on our caregiving system is huge. The weight of that on our taxation is huge. The weight of that on our families is huge. Pay attention. The brain you save may be your own. I'm Eve Prang-Palouse. I'm a licensed nutrition counselor and Institute for Functional Medicine certified practitioner. I've been in practice here in Sarasota for 26 years and on